On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass student Maura Murray drove from her dorm in Amherst, Massachusetts to the White Mountains of New Hampshire.
At approximately 7:27 p.m., Maura spun out her 1996 Saturn on a hairpin turn on Route 112 in North Haverhill. There has never been a credible sighting of Maura since.
Maura is 5'7" tall. She weighs 120 pounds, and she has brown hair and hazel eyes.
If you have any information regarding Maura's disappearance, please submit it to us, the Murray family, through their Facebook page, or the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit.
This is Missing Maura Murray. Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. I'm Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawl Space Studios in Wormtown. Lance, how are you today?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling like 2020 is starting off with a bang. How do you feel?
I feel pretty good. It is good. 2020. We're here in a new land, and this episode, Lance, I guess it does kind of take us by surprise a little bit. We talked to author James Renner again. James Renner, of course, he wrote the book True Crime Addict. And in this episode, he talks about a trial recently that Maura's ex-boyfriend, Bill Rausch, went through in the Washington, D.C. area.
There was an alleged victim who was accusing Bill of sexual abuse and also of physical abuse, which was subsequent to the alleged sexual abuse. And James Renner had been looking into this about 4 years ago or more. As far as we know, it was around 4 years ago where he started looking into this. Which brings me to an interesting revelation that we have in this episode, and I'm not sure if I articulated it, shockingly enough, I'm not sure if I articulated it the way I should have, but the information that James has provided in a lot of the circumstances of this case, not just this one that we're talking about today, have proven to have more truth than fantasy, which I feel is sort of telling of his work that goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people kind of chalked this information up to Rennerism or kind of conflated the Bill Rausch abuse allegations with a personal story that Renner was kind of seeing through, you know?
Yeah.
But it turns out that's not really it, because we have court transcripts and a lot of this stuff is real, and Maura Murray's name appears in the court transcripts.
Yes, Maura Murray's name does appear in the transcript numerous times, as does James Renner's name and Aaron Larkin's name.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that I don't think it's fair to call this information a distraction at this point. I understand what someone means if they say that, but to call anything a distraction presumes you know what happened in the case, and I don't know what happened. I don't think anyone else does, but maybe someone listening does. And we want to give out some phone numbers here. If you are feeling unsafe at home or with your partner, please call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 7233. And if you're feeling down this holiday season or this winter, there are people out there who want to help. Please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It's 1-800-273-8255.
And if you're not sure whether or not you need to take these steps, this is a very good point, Tim, that you made. Call those numbers. But if you're not sure that you're ready to make that move yet, if you're concerned about a situation that's going on in your life, you simply need to listen to your family and friends. If anyone has warned you about anything that they see from outside of your immediate orbit in your world that they're concerned about your safety, whether it's from somebody else or yourself, you need to listen to them. And then you need to make those calls.
Okay, Lance, just a couple of quick announcements before we get to the interview with James Renner. We are hitting the road in 2020 in March. We're going to Boston with the podcast True Crime Obsessed, and we're going to Philadelphia. It's March 20th and March 21st. We're doing a couple of shows in those cities, or one show in each of those cities, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Come check it out. It's truecrimeobsessed.com, and you can get tickets there, or there is a link in the show notes.
Yep. Go to truecrimeobsessed.com and click the See Us Live, and you'll be able to buy your tickets there. Boston is at Club Royale, and Philadelphia is at Underground Arts. And we will be announcing, because this show is about the Moore Murray case and our involvement in it with Maggie Freeling, we will be announcing a text-to-donate option at the live show as a way to recharge the GoFundMe fundraising campaign started by ourselves and by Maggie.
And also, our full archive is back on the public feed, so check it out. You can binge. Yeah, you can hear every single episode of Missing Maura Murray. We're over 100. And we just released a new batch of creators' commentary episodes, Lance, on Stitcher Premium. So check those out at stitcherpremium.com. We did episodes 61 to 70, and we have 10 more to go.
Fun times listening to those creator commentaries and fun times doing them. If you want an opportunity to hear Tim and I really give it to ourselves, go ahead and check that out. It's become a bit of a wild train ride, if you will.
Okay, everybody. Thank you very much for listening, and let's get to the interview. Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. James Renner, how are you today, James?
I am just fine on this last day of 2019, the last day of the decade, the last day of the tens, the teens, whatever we're calling them.
How do you feel the teens went for you, personally and professionally?
Ups and downs, ups and downs.
Ebbs and flows.
Ebbs and flows. This is overall a productive 10 years, I think. I look back on it with fondness. At least that's what I tell myself. No, I at the beginning of this decade, I lost my job. I was fired from Cleveland Scene magazine for telling my boss to go fuck himself. And then I had no plan. That gave me time to finish my first novel. And here we are 10 years later, and I'm able to do this for a living. So, and I'm back to writing for Cleveland Scene, the magazine that showed me the door. the CEO has switched over. So it's all come around full circle. It's like the Nietzsche life is a flat circle. It's that eternal return. So I guess I haven't gone very far in the 10 years, but it seems like a long journey to get back to where I started.
Well, just the 10 years alone, or the 10 years aside, this year in particular has been really eventful. We had you on just a couple of months ago, just a few weeks ago, and you always managed to, I guess, cause some waves. But Tim and I were talking, I think maybe last week or a few weeks ago, everything that you have researched in the past year, actually in the past, 4 years, I'm not going to say was taken with maybe some creative license, but some of the things were maybe considered as James Renner being a sensationalist, and we keep using that word, but as we get later on in this investigation and this case, as things progress, it feels like if you're not 100% accurate, there's a lot that is a reality to what you have been looking into. So I personally have started to train myself to consider everything that is a potential scenario that you deliver to your audience.
Thanks.
I'm being intentionally vague because I don't want to paint myself into a corner.
Right. No, thank you. I wish I could say that it was a planned, long game, long con or something, but, these stories that I've been talking about, specifically with Bill Rausch and, some of these other characters, it got caught up in the justice system, and the justice system is so slow, especially in DC, where some of these crimes occurred. So, for instance, I knew about the grand jury years ago, but the grand jury went on for almost a year before they issued charges against Bill. So while I knew it was a reality, it allowed people to, you know, get online and say, oh, rah, 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 you know, James Renner's making this up. This isn't happening. And there wasn't much I could do to defend myself. But now it's coming out.
Yeah, I think people thought that maybe this was you pushing because you had an axe to grind or something like that. A lot of people, a lot of resistance inside the Mormon community to kind of talk about this stuff because we know Bill has such a good alibi in being in Oklahoma. But we spoke to Bill about a year ago, and he told us...
Yeah, tell me about that. That's always been like a rumor.
Well, he told us you were lying about the grand jury.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's funny is he knew, like, Bill knew about the grand jury for many different reasons. You know, people... You know, they served a subpoena at the place he used to be the executive director for, and there's no way he couldn't have known that they did that. So they were getting all that investigative files from when he worked at Ray Group International, and they had their own internal investigation when this woman said that he tried to rape her in the office. And further, more than that, in D.C., the way grand juries work is it's technically a federal grand jury, even though he was ended up going to D.C. Superior Court. It's a felony. But the way the grand jury system works, it's a sitting federal grand jury. So, which is only important because when a federal grand jury begins to investigate you, you get what's called a target letter. So Bill would have received a target letter that said, hey, you're under investigation by a grand jury in D.C. So, you know, in light of that, you know, what do you think of Bill Rausch's credibility at this point?
Well, before we get to that, I just want to be clear for anybody who's listening. We are speaking of Bill Rausch, and I just want to be clear of the charges. The charges and the grand jury and the subpoena that you're speaking of were based on what?
An alleged assault that took place on St. Patrick's Day in 2011 in the offices of Ray Group International. A young woman claims that he tried to rape her in the office of the president of Ray Group International after work one day and, you know, pushed her down on a table and started grinding up against her, trying to put his hands under her clothing. And luckily that assault was interrupted by another coworker coming in and knocking on the door. Bill then told her, don't say a fucking word about this, and then hid under the desk while she ran out. This same woman claims that he pushed her down in the metro station, and if you on the escalators, and if you've ever been on the escalators, we're talking like a two-story escalator. So in my mind, that's I don't know what you're doing other than trying to seriously hurt somebody, if not kill them. A crime, unfortunately, was beyond the statute of limitations. So he was ultimately just charged with felony sexual abuse, which carries a possible sentence of 8 years in prison. Now, in the interim, you know, he was taken to court by his girlfriend, who he had had an affair with for a couple years and had met at a place called, you know, in the Veterans Affairs community in D.C. She filed for a restraining order, a protective order. And most of the times, you know, nobody goes to trial over something like that. You just kind of, you know, because you don't have anything to gain really as a defendant except for airing all this dirty laundry. But Bill went to court and just a couple weeks ago, and it was a 3-day trial that he put this victim through. And in the end, he was found guilty responsible for this. The judge said, you know, anybody would look at it as stalking behavior. And he had to pay this woman, like, I think close to $2,000 for what she put into a new security system. Very scary stuff came out in that trial. So more charges may come out of that because the protection order was just a civil case. But now that it's done, you know, there very well may be another grand jury investigating these new claims, and I expect it to lead to more felony charges.
Okay, and when did this all come, like, go down?
With the woman, this girlfriend?
Yeah. When did? So you said a protection order was issued. Is that I guess, similar to a restraining order?
Yeah, it's kind of a longer term restraining order. So there's a temporary restraining order you get, and then you have to go to court. And if the court finds that you're in danger, they can issue a longer restraining order. And that's what this is. And it just happened late November 2019. And here we are at the end of December. I was just able to get the transcripts from that case about a week ago. And while I couldn't outright publish the transcripts for many reasons involving, like, you know, there's a victim here that should remain anonymous and protected. But also they're saying that these records may be sealed. I was able to read through them all. And, you know, there's a lot of crazy stuff that came out during that trial.
Okay. So this was like a legit trial. Like there was a prosecution, a defense. The witness was on the stand providing answers and statements. Was it open to the public or to the press?
It was, yeah. So it would have been open to public and press. There was a reporter there the first day, unable to return the next 2 days. I was not able to get there. And I just didn't want to add drama to the whole situation. So I stayed away. But yeah, no, there was... so there were essentially only two people that ended up on the stand. There was the victim, and then there was Bill himself. And, but there was, on the witness list for Bill Rausch was Aaron Larkin, you know, who you guys know through this podcast and through, you know, her involvement with the Murray family. She was a witness for Bill Rausch, but never ultimately called.
A character witness.
Well, I wouldn't say character witness, more of a witness that they were going to use to poke holes into the victim's story. Because backing up a little bit, this woman involved in the protection order was a girlfriend of Bill Rausch's for a number of years when he was still married. In fact, Bill has not yet, as far as I know, officially divorced his wife, although they have been separated for more than a year. But this girl, this young woman has been around for a while. And she alleges that, you know, from the beginning, the relationship was abusive. And, so how does Aaron Larkin figure in? Well, when Bill was deployed to East Africa last year, he, before that introduced, I think, you know, maybe over email, but introduced the victim to Aaron Larkin and said that this was a person she could trust while he was away. And so they got together and had kind of a weird little friendship. But eventually the victim realized she could not trust Aaron Larkin because she caught her recording her without her permission at a bar. You know, it's a weird story in itself. Aaron asked her to come to this bar and, you know, Scott Wall shows up, uninvited and, creeps everybody out. You know, the victim was so afraid of Scott Wall that she, asked these guys that she met at the bar to escort her out and away. And you know, Aaron's there trying to tape her. So she becomes a witness in the case and, that Bill's lawyers can use to, poke holes in the victim's story, because Aaron was saying that this woman never said that Bill harmed her, never said she was afraid of Bill. Although during the trial, it comes out that there are these texts between the victim and Aaron in which the victim specifically says, you know, she's afraid of Bill. So make of that what you will. It's a big mess.
It's all quite shocking.
Yeah.
I got to be honest. I'm completely blown away by all of this having happened. Wait, did you say that Bill introduced the victim to Aaron?
Yes, in some form that happened, whether it was over email, whether it was, you know, over the phone or in person. And eventually they all began to communicate through various forms of social media about, you know, the best. Essentially, the three of them were discussing the best ways to mitigate the information that was coming out about Bill and these grand juries and his attacking these women. So Bill, while he was over in East Africa, is on these chain of emails between the victim and Aaron Larkin, in which they discuss creating fake Twitter accounts in order to attack my credibility and to dox me and to force me to take down the blog and the information about Bill Rausch attacking these women. And they, you know, for a time, they made my life very difficult. And I, in fact, took down the blog for a little while just so I didn't have to deal with this craziness. And eventually figured it out and who was behind that, and then brought the blog back after Bill was ultimately charged with this sex abuse. So, you know, they communicated, they built these fake accounts on Twitter, and then they also, Bill suggested they communicate through a social media app called WhatsApp that is specifically used to for secure communication, so that it would be harder to subpoena later, and easy to keep your anonymity.
What year did all of this happen?
Oh, this was mostly last. It would have been end of summer 2018 through the fall of 2018.
Okay, end of the summer 2018 through the fall of 2018. That's when these email communications between Bill and Aaron occurred, saying that they needed to mitigate some of the damage by creating fake profiles on social media.
You know, word for word, I don't know what was said. All I know that the email communication was about the creation of these fake Twitter profiles and how they would be used to attack my credibility.
It was specifically your credibility.
Yeah.
And what was the, I guess it's just your opinion because you didn't read them, but why would they be attacking your credibility?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's very simple. I was the only person that was reporting on these allegations that Bill had sexually harassed and attempted to rape a number of women in D.C. So I think he thought if he was able to take down my blog, then it would be a lot harder for him to you know, face repercussions for his actions. Attack the messenger, you know?
Yeah. Now, I'm sure some people are curious, and I'm curious as well. Would the reaction be the same, in your opinion, if someone was innocent of these charges and a reporter or a journalist was investigating them? Is that a typical reaction, that, in your opinion?
No. No, if you're innocent of these charges, what you do is you get a lawyer and you sue. But if you're not innocent of these charges and you need that information to go away, then you do shady stuff like this to try to chip away at the credibility of the reporter, or just to cause, you know, chaos and strife in order to force them to take it down.
So is there anything in the transcripts of how long Aaron and Bill have known each other then? I'm sorry to harp on that. I'm just kind of confused.
It's hard to tell from the transcripts. And ultimately Aaron was never called. I think his lawyer eventually figured that would not be a good thing to do. So the way that the trial worked out, so this woman is accusing Bill of stalking her, and you know, in her complaint, you know, and in the opening statements of her attorney, a lot of stuff comes out where this girl would have known Bill better than anybody. In fact, I think better than his wife. They carried on this affair for I think 2 or 3 years. And, you know, she talks about how from the very beginning, what he liked to do is he liked to choke her during sex, and he would call her Maura, you know, for Maura Murray, and you know, he would get off on choking her, calling her Maura, and he would be demeaning towards her when she was playing the role of Maura. So he would say, you know, you're a bitch, you know, you're a whore, crazy stuff. So he's already choking her and calling the her the name of this girlfriend who went missing in 2004. This raises, of course, a couple red flags with this girl, this other victim. And, you know, so she sees my posts on the case and these other women coming forward. And Bill at first convinces her and a lot of other people that I'm lying, that I'm making this up, that these women are lying. But eventually, you know, his physical abuse towards this woman becomes more and more severe. You know, he hit her once so hard that she chipped a tooth. He would, you know, hit her so hard that he would leave bruises. And then he would ask her to take pictures of those bruises and send to him so he could get off on it. You know, he enjoyed the physical abuse there.
Let me stop you there for a second, because I just want to point something out. This is something that me and Lance were kind of talking about. It's like, if you were to say this was true about any other person in the case, like say this was true about Rick, the neighbor, all this stuff came out about him. Like, yeah. What do you think the community would do? Like, yeah. Holy moly. Right.
Yeah.
So I think it's perplexing, that this is happening now. Like we always say, you know, if Moira was met with foul play, this person can't be good forever. They're going to have to screw up at some point. I just think no one was looking in Bill's direction, like for that.
That's exactly right.
You know what I mean? And then when all these charges happen, it's downright shocking. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, because it's always been a very easy defense for him to say, oh, I was at Fort Sill, you know, I couldn't have been there. But, you know, of course, now in light of this, you know, and we're talking now, I think the number's up to about six women who have come forward alleging everything from sexual harassment all the way up to rape. What we can take away from this for sure is that this is a guy who likes to inflict pain and likes to hurt women and has been doing so for many, many years. So you go back to that alibi, and, you know, I'm going to come right out and say it. I think it's at a point now where the police, if they haven't done so already, need to seriously consider Bill Rausch as a suspect in the disappearance of Moira Murray. You know, I'm not saying he did it. I don't know if he did it. I certainly think they and I'm not the only one asking them to investigate. You know, it's these victims themselves who have said that the police should be looking at this guy. So go to the alibi where he's at Fort Sill. You know, he provided me with the names of two soldiers that worked with him at Fort Sill, you know, on the day that Moira went missing. You know, I've attempted to contact them a number of times. I have the private emails. They've never answered. So I've personally never been able to verify his alibi. But regardless, I don't know how important that alibi is, because the one thing I've come to believe over the years is that, you know, she wasn't traveling alone. I firmly believe that in this tandem driver theory that a friend or somebody was with her, and that's who picked her up. And I think she made it to a cabin or a condo, so if she was met with foul play, perhaps it came later in the week, like Wednesday or Friday.
Getting back to the incidents that you mentioned about Bill choking his accuser and hitting her so hard that it left bruises, and he wanted her to take pictures and send those pictures to him so he could get off on them. Where is this information coming from?
This is from the victim. This is during when she was on the stand at this trial. This is information that came out then.
And are these pictures available? Were they available for the jury? Was this a jury trial?
It was a... that's a good question. I don't know if there was a sitting jury. It was a civil trial. So the judge was making a lot of contacts comments. I don't believe there was a jury, because ultimately it was the judge who ruled on this.
Okay. Were the pictures available for the judge to see?
I'm not sure. It's hard to tell, because all I have are the transcripts. They mention evidence. I know one thing that happened during the trial. Sorry, I got my dog just jumped on me.
Oh, you got a dog. I didn't know you're a dog person.
Oh yeah, you know, Brownie.
I do? I didn't know Brownie.
Brownie!
The one thing that did come out in trial is that there was a, day two kind of ends with Bill Rausch's attorney revealing the existence of a sex tape. And, it's kind of this big, gotcha moment, I think they were trying to play. And by bringing it up, what they were trying to do is say that the victim enjoyed rough sex. And that's what was on this tape. And that if she enjoyed rough sex, she couldn't have possibly had any problems with her, with him hitting her, apparently, I guess was their defense. So this tape was played in court. I'm not sure, it's possible only the victim was able to see it, but the judge allowed the tape to be played. And then that to me is just the craziest thing. Now, I've been covering court cases for 15 years, and I've never heard anything that like that. And to me, that's just, that tells me that, I think their strategy was to try to shame the victim in the hopes that she would say, okay, please just don't show the tape. I'll drop charges, but she didn't, she stood strong.
Right. I think that speaks a lot to her credibility. Because absolutely. If she was lying about this, wouldn't you just quit right there?
Right. Exactly.
So this sex tape that they actually eventually in day three of this trial that they showed in court showed abuse of Bill on her.
I think what it showed was spanking. I don't know how hard the spanking was, but I think what the defense was trying to do was say, well, if she's into spanking, then, how can she complain about the backhanding, which is a ridiculous argument, but one that they, I think that was how they reasoned it.
And you were saying that the affair went on while Bill was married. He's since been separated from his wife. This went on for 2 or 3 years, I think you said. So this goes back to maybe 2016?
Something like that. Yeah, up until March of this past year where, the victim, I think there was essentially sort of an intervention by her family where they're like, hey, dude, this guy's no good. Yeah. This guy's no good for you. And we're scared. So she contacted Bill, I think in March or very early April and said very politely, we're done. I can't do this anymore. And also there are texts during this time and conversations with Bill that came out in court where, he apologizes for, the pain he's caused her and he promises, not to hit her again. And, it's rough stuff. So anyway, she breaks it off and then he doesn't take no for an answer. And, she logs every contact that he tries to make with her after that. And very smartly keeps a list of this. And, he's contacting her through every form of social media, liking her photos on Instagram and Facebook in order to get it so she sees the notification. When he gets back, mind you, he returns to the United States where he's promptly taken in for because he's got a warrant out for his arrest on the sexual abuse charge. And now he's trying to win over his girlfriend who he's cheating on his wife with. And he shows up at this girl's apartment, this young woman's apartment. And, he's still got the keys to, and she hasn't changed the locks yet. And so she's frightened to death. And she, at that moment, calls a domestic violence hotline. And he slips this note under her door just stalkery behavior. But anyways, these contacts, they number over, I think, 100 in the span of just a couple weeks. So it was frightening. And that's what led her to come forward and press charges and get this protective order and contact me. She reached out to me.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com. Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
And correct me if I'm wrong with the timing on slipping that note under the door, but what I gathered from reading what you wrote about it on your blog was that she had the locks changed, the lock to her door, but not the outdoor to the apartment. And so he potentially used that key for that door?
You know, I think that's accurate. Yeah, I think that's right.
In the transcript from November, does she specifically say she is scared of Bill?
Yeah. In fact, she comes out and says that the reason she reached out to me when I was in DC, I think this was back in September or October. She reached out to me because she was worried that she was going to go missing, that she was worried that Bill had something to do with Maura Murray's disappearance in light of everything that had happened to her and these other women. And she was terrified that, that she was going to go missing, that she was going to get murdered or something. And, I told her then, I'm like, I can write, the best I can do is write a book about you, And, so I think that's when, she had already made up her mind to talk to the police, but, I think she realized kind of the predicament that she had found herself in.
Was your name mentioned in the court transcript?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And in what context was your name mentioned? Because wasn't this a trial about a protective order against Bill?
Yeah. Yeah. So what Bill's lawyer was attempting to do is I assume what she's going to try for her defense against, in this upcoming sexual assault case that happens in D.C. in May, which is to blame me. Their defense is that I am this out of control gonzo journalist who has convinced these weak women that they were assaulted by Bill, and none of it is true. Now, hopefully this case shows them how ridiculous that argument is, because it sure didn't help them here. But yeah, my name comes up a lot because Bill's lawyer is trying to get the victim to say that I'm a terrible person, that she didn't trust me either, that I lied about a bunch of stuff. And, the victim kept saying, of course I thought Renner was a bad guy when I was hooking up with Bill, because I only heard Bill's point of view. When I woke up and got out from under his, his cult.
The Rausch fog.
The Rausch fog, if you will. Yeah. She realized that everything I said was true. So, my name comes up because that's their defense, is that, if not for me, Bill wouldn't be in trouble at all.
And is Aaron Larkin's name brought up in the court transcript?
Quite a bit. Yep. And that's because of this friendship that she had fostered with the victim. Now, a couple of interesting things do come up with that, though. We learn that this ridiculous plan that Aaron had for getting me out of CrimeCon, which, the lengths, that people went through just to keep me out of a convention is bizarre and surreal to see it you know, coming out in a trial. But Aaron was trying to get the victim to file a restraining order against me in New Orleans, so that I could not attend CrimeCon if she was there. So this comes up in court, and they ask, yes,
what?
So they asked the victim, you know, because the way Aaron put it to Bill and Bill's attorney is, well, the victim was so scared of James Renner that she wanted to take out a file, you know, a restraining order. And so they get the victim up there and they ask her about this. And the victim's like, no, that was never my idea. That was never my intent. I was not scared of James Renner like that. You know, that was never something I wanted to do. So, you know, but that's something that Aaron's put out there and claimed to be true, that was found false in this trial. You know, it's bizarre and a little scary that people are spending that much time trying to keep me out of CrimeCon.
My gosh. One other thing I wanted to mention is that Twitter has picked up on the story, and there's sort of like a mini viral moment that developed a couple of times now, once at the end of November and once just recently a few days ago here at the end of December in 2019. But several people tweeting about Bill and about these charges, people who have worked with Bill in the past, people who are in government in the D.C. area still now.
Yeah. No, it was great. You know, so when I posted about the transcripts and I was able to prove finally that, you know, not only that there were more women out there that he was found to have stalked this woman, but now that everything was public, it allowed everybody else that had been kind of waiting in the wings to step forward and voice their opinion. So, you know, there were a number of people from the Veterans Affairs community who knew the truth about Bill and had their own run-ins with Bill and their own opinions about them that now felt that they could speak out. And they did. You know, they came out in support of this woman. And in fact, I wish I had been at the trial because, you know, I spoke to somebody who was there. And they told me this wonderful story about how, you know, day one, day two, Bill and his lawyer were, you know, coming out and just trouncing this woman, this victim, and to the point where she was, you know, like anybody else would have been, very intimidated. So day three, you know, Bill Rouse strolls into this courtroom thinking that he's winning. And he looks up, and the first thing he sees are a couple of marshals, U.S. marshals, and they're there to keep the peace because they heard that this witness was being intimidated. And then he sees all these people he worked with in the Veterans Affairs community. So I don't know if it was the victim that invited them or if word got out, but all these people showed up in support of this victim. And Bill realized that all this was getting out, and these people were going to be witnesses to what he had to say. This running this victim through the coals, and the tide turned, and he was very flustered on stage and started stammering and lost his cool, and that's kind of when everything turned in favor of the victim. So it was just the way it was described to me was kind of a movie moment, you know.
For sure, yeah. Well, I think that's really powerful, and I think if there are other people out there who have experienced anything at the hands of Bill Rausch, really, I think it would be great to speak up now. And I want to put a personal call out at this point to Kate and Sarah, to Kate Markopoulos and Sarah Alfieri. I think they need to speak out now. I think it's more important now than ever, because if they don't speak out now, it just looks worse for Bill. Anyone who knows either Kate or Sarah needs to encourage them to speak up now.
I agree. You know, I think that Kate and Sarah had an inkling of how dangerous Bill Rausch was. And what they should know now is he can't hurt anybody anymore. you know, there's too much support, there's too much attention. And if you have information that, that he was like this with Maura, if this was what Maura was trying to get away from, if this is what she was able to get away from, yeah, now's the time to come forward and talk.
Yeah, I think it's important. If they never witnessed abuse from Bill to Maura, they need to speak up to clear his name.
Yeah, yeah. We've been, you know, we've been waiting for them to tell what they know for a while. And hopefully they know that we're supportive and everybody's after the same thing, which is, you know, finding out what happened to her and if Bill was involved in any way.
I want to talk, real quickly or I mean, as in depth as you want to talk about an event that happened on Valentine's Day in 2018 between the accuser and Bill. What was this event that happened on Valentine's Day in 2018?
Yeah, so this is kind of the first story where I became aware of this victim and her involvement with Bill, and I reached out to her. I talked to her because I had heard the story that Bill was on Valentine's Day 2018. Bill was seen in the ER with a woman who had gone in there because she had suffered head trauma. And so my first thought after knowing these other allegations was, you know, what did he do to this woman? And so I was able to get the victim's name and I reached out to her. And at first she, you know, denied Bill had anything to do with it. You know, but, you know, Bill is very, you know, it is when you get close to him, it is kind of cultish, you know, the Bill Rausch fog or whatever you want to call it. So she was still kind of under his spell and of course defending him, didn't want anybody to know that in fact, he was the reason she was at the ER on Valentine's Day. What came out in court was, I think the rest of the story, which is, you know, at the time she was with, another guy and she had told Bill that they were done. But Bill wasn't taking no for an answer and showing up. And, you know, he'd do stuff like buy her a laptop or, you know, pay for food. And, you know, he was always using money as a way to ingratiate himself with her. And so he shows up on Valentine's Day. And at first she's like, no, I don't want you in. You know, I'm meeting my boyfriend. And he, you know, he sweet talks his way into the apartment and starts fooling around with her. And the story that comes out is that he tossed her into the air and accidentally hit her head on a lamp or a light fixture that was hanging down from the ceiling. Whether it was accidental or on purpose or whatever, I wasn't in the room, but she does get a major gash in her head and there's just blood everywhere. And Bill starts freaking out and he says they should call 911. Eventually they do. You know, and then he starts taking pictures of everything. You know, her and her gash, and he talks his way into the, you know, I don't know if he goes, I think he's in the ambulance with her. If not, he follows because he's there at the hospital. And his main concern at that time was me finding out. He's like, the last thing I need is James Renner finding out about what's happening right now. So I think there's even a picture maybe with him in the ambulance with her, but he's taking pictures with her in the hospital. He's there when the nurses come in and, you know, convinces them, like tells everybody, oh, I'm her point of contact, and makes them put his name down as the point of contact for her. He's very concerned about this getting out in any way. That's the long and short of what happened there.
And when Bill was present in the courtroom, did he have any family members there with him to support him?
I heard that there were family members there, but I wasn't there. I don't know for sure who it was. Another reporter who was there told me it looked like his mother and sister might be there. That first day, while they were waiting for court, Bill was out in there sitting with Aaron Larkin in view of the victim. So I'm sure that was not very comfortable for the victim to see.
And you heard that through
a reporter who was in the hallway. Yeah.
Okay. And did they ever talk to Bill during the trial about his involvement with Maura and her disappearance specifically?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They come right out and ask him if he murdered Maura Murray.
Oh.
And
they did?
Yeah.
And what did he say?
He said no. You know, he said, you know, he was never even considered a suspect, which is untrue. You know, if only for the fact that as soon as he arrived in New Hampshire on Wednesday, the first thing that happened was he was interrogated by the police. You know, and again, I want to say, you know, I don't know for sure that he had anything to do with, you know, if Moore is dead, I don't know if he's responsible for that. But I think everything that we do know sheds a light on why Mora had motivation to leave or to want to get away, whether it was for a short length of time or forever. You know, this is, who could be, you're in a relationship with somebody, how bad can they be for you to want to start a new life? Well, Bill Rausch happens to be one of these people that who you'd want to get away from forever.
Yeah, and I would have to say I'm a little concerned for Erin and what she's been up to lately. I don't understand it. I'm confused, and I would say concerned too. I think if she's been working with Bill in some kind of misinformation campaign for years, I think that's highly concerning. And if she hasn't been doing that, I'm also concerned because of her behavior recently.
Yeah, she's all over this for some reason. Another thing that came out that she was involved with is again with this CrimeCon convention, right? So she and Bill were trying to get a panel together for CrimeCon last year, and the title of that would have been "What It's Like to Be Accused of Murder," and it would have been Bill Rausch speaking out about how I was attacking him and making everything up about this grand jury that didn't exist. Well, luckily, I had to talk to the people in charge of CrimeCon, and I told them, I'm like, this grand jury's real, guys. And they're like, well, you know, he's saying it's not. Luckily, he was charged, and they dropped that panel, and they realized that Erin and Bill had been lying that whole time.
And what were they saying that you were doing in regards to attacking Bill? Were you talking to his employers or his family?
Mostly it was the posting on the blog and the epilogue that was in my book, you know, that they were saying that all that stuff was untrue, that I was making this stuff up and attacking him for no reason. I guess their reasoning was it was going to sell more copies of my book. So I'm a big capitalist, I guess. you know, it's weird. One other thing that we should talk about are the number of people that Bill worked with when he was deployed at Camp Lemoneer in East Africa who have since filed grievances with the inspector or complaints with the Inspector General Office. So these other soldiers in the Army have filed complaints against Bill for his leadership while they were working with him because he was doing crazy stuff over there. Whenever anybody would find out about these charges against him in the States and this grand jury, he would have him transferred off base. There's this guy that came forward publicly after this latest trial. His name's Matt Fecto. And he alleges that Bill just made his life a living hell, created a toxic workplace, stalked him on social media. Then when he found out that he knew about these this grand jury, had him transferred off base, really screwed with him in creepy ways. The way he just goes over and above somebody that's acting rationally. And but here's the weird thing is Matt Fecto is Erin Larkin's cousin.
Yeah, that is weird. Have they connected about this? Do you know?
They have. And I don't want to go into that because, you know, those conversations I'm sure are personal, but, like you, he's very concerned about her, and feels as though she was taken in by Bill and for whatever reason, she's drinking the Kool-Aid.
That's, yeah, I'm trying to wrap my head around that.
Yeah, he ran for office at one point, right?
Fecto did.
I think he did. Yeah.
Yeah. He ran for Senate.
He's a smart guy, knows a lot, and you know, thought he could go to his cousin and say, hey, here's everything that Bill did to me, very similar to what he did to these women. It's all true. And it fell on deaf ears.
I want to get back real quick to those who talk about your harassment of Bill by contacting his employers and his family. Did you ever contact his employers and his family and make it appear that you were going to go on this like scorched earth tour to destroy him?
As a reporter, especially as an investigative reporter, you should be contacting any source you can reach, especially if the allegations are so severe, which in this case we're talking about rape. So in order to verify that what the victim is saying is true, I need supportive evidence, and I need other witnesses. I need other people supporting what she's telling me. So of course I spoke to, I reached out to everybody you worked with, as many as I could. And some of them told me additional stories. Some of them were very helpful as sources, and to this day are. I wouldn't say I contacted his family, although a couple years ago, I think it's been 2 or 3 years, I did send one email to his wife because I was concerned specifically about a case he has not been charged with yet that she might have some information about. So I reached out to her and I said, this will be the only time I try to contact you. Here's why I'm trying to contact you. If you don't want to talk to me, that's fine, but I feel as though you need to know this for your own safety. So yeah, I contacted a ton of people, some people he went to school with back at West Point.
Is he still currently an active military member?
I don't know. I don't know where he stands with the military. He could be facing charges in military court because of this latest witness. He flew this victim out to Germany. When he was deployed, he was at a conference in Germany, and she is alleging that he assaulted her on a military base, on a U.S. military base in Germany, and hit her repeatedly there, in which case that would be military court.
You just said he hit her repeatedly there.
Yeah.
And that's documented at hospitals or with law enforcement there or with military police?
I don't know if she kept pictures or what, but that's the story that she's telling, that she alleges.
That's the same victim from court recently?
Yes.
Okay.
There's a lot that's come out, and you know, this sexual abuse trial is slated for May 1st of 2019, and both sides are going to be entering
2020.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, 2020. Yeah. So it's going to go on for a little bit,
and what is that trial?
That's the sexual abuse trial related to the assault that took place in 2011.
Yeah. Gotcha. Hard for me to keep track.
At this point, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know where the cold case unit is. I don't know where, they are with looking at him as a possible suspect. But these victims want police to hear what they're saying and to take it seriously and review where he was, not just the day of the disappearance, but in the days following the disappearance. He tells this story about this. This is another thing the victim spoke about, is this story about where he finds this shed in the woods when he's searching with his father. And I think we mentioned this in the last podcast, but something about that story does not sit well with the victim. And she wants police to figure out where he was when he was looking for Maura, if it's possible that he found her, if, you know, the shed is involved in any way.
And she says that during this trial.
I don't think it comes out in trial.
Okay.
What we're touching on here is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to this trial. There's a ton of other stories. There are a lot of other stories that came out during the trial that are too, I think, salacious for us to get into. It speaks to, you know, their sexual proclivities and what they're into. One thing that could also end up being a news story here is the victim on the stand talks about a friend of Bill's who now works, who went to school with him at West Point, and is still friends with Bill, and he now works for the White House. And she alleges that this man also assaulted her. You know, and I just want to one last time reiterate, I don't know what happened to Maura Murray, but, you know, I sure hope she got away and she's fine. And maybe now, if that's the case, now that, that Bill's under a microscope and, you know, possibly, you know, ends up serving some time, maybe it's safe enough for her to come forward. Worst case scenario, if she is dead, you know, I just, you know, I don't know what happened to her, but I think Bill Rausch deserves to be looked at a little closer.
I think that's a solid thing to say, because to be clear, we're not saying that these are connected. We're just saying that a person who is connected to Maura now is facing some very, very, very serious charges.
Let's play the thought exercise one last time. What if these charges came out about Tim Carpenter right now? How would people feel?
Exactly. I'd go one step further and say, what if these charges came out about somebody who didn't cry foul that James Renner was trying to out them?
What do you mean?
Like, what if these charges came out about me or Tim? You know. Just in general, not because we're not even related to the case itself. Like, no one ever questions where we were at. I'm just curious, if we're playing a thought exercise, if these charges came out against us and you weren't involved in them coming out, what would the repercussions be on us?
It would surely look a lot weirder, like what we've been doing for the past few years.
Oh, yes, exactly my point. Then people would start putting us under a microscope and saying, well, I don't think that they should be involved in this. If I, you know, regardless of guilt or innocence, if they have these charges, there's something there that shouldn't be there when people search Maura Murray to take away from the actual investigation.
Well, yeah, you would think that, yes. And I see where you're headed. Although I see we're coming up on an hour, and to begin on the craziness that surrounds the administrator of the Maura Murray Facebook page, Scott Wall, would take another episode.